Welcome back, guys. This is Red Ice. I'm Henrik. Thank you for tuning in. We are doing audio only today as we're on the road, not really equipped to do video recordings with multiple guests remotely. So there you have it. I guess this is Red Ice Radio today then, as opposed to TV. But today on the show, we have Laura and William from Defend Europa with us. Welcome, guys. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, good to be here.
I've heard a lot about Defend Europa in the last couple of weeks. A lot of good stuff, of course, on the website, guys. You're doing a lot of good work. Tell us a bit about the background for those who don't know. Who ended up starting it? How did you guys get involved? And then later, of course, we can talk more about some of the issues that you are really kind of passionate about. But what should people know about the background of Defend Europa?
Well, it was basically a group of us who just sort of got talking on the internet from all different parts of Europe. And we sort of, you know, we said between us that this is something that we want to do. We want to start a project. We want to raise awareness. And it happened very quickly. You know, we got some branding, we got a website, and then we, you know, I guess later on, Laura joined us as a writer, and we've got a few others, and it's all happened pretty quickly, and it's grown, you know, equally quickly. And Laura, I guess you can talk a bit more about, you know, where we're going from here and the aims and that sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. We're basically a small volunteer-run news network, so we all have full-time jobs, but then we volunteer at Defend Europe as well in our spare time. And the idea really is that we try to bring completely uncensored news, basically to anyone that holds Europe in their heart. So we've got a lot of followers from Europe, but also America, South Africa, Australia as well. And the things that we talk about are basically the migrant crisis, population replacement, Islam, the EU, the establishment. We talk a lot about the things that we want to preserve. So we talk about the beauty of Europe, history, culture, art, architecture, philosophy. But then we also talk about the ugly side as well. So things like terrorism, crime, a lack of integration. But I think the main thing to remember is that we just try to completely not hold back. So if we're going to publish an article and we know that maybe it's a little bit controversial, but it's true, we will still publish that article. But everything's backed up by facts and statistics and evidence.
Well, very, very good. So let's just get one thing out of the way immediately, because I did confuse the organizations here. In the last couple of days, we've heard about Defend Europe, another group who's raised some money for the boat as well. You guys are not part of that, correct?
That's right. The boat, the guys with the boats have nothing to do with us, although I think we would consider them allies in the cause.
Yeah, that's good. It's too bad the names are very similar, of course, but maybe I don't know if that's an accident or whatnot. But have you guys spoken with anyone from that group about the name?
I'm not sure. I don't think so. I think they messaged us and asked if we wanted to get involved or something a while back.
I'm not sure if it was a direct representative. I mean, we've had a lot of people, you know, come up to us individually and sort of say, oh, you're the guys with the boats. And we're like, no, we're not. But, you know, whatever. But I mean, I guess I would know they did start a bit later than us. We've had the website up a bit longer. But it's good that, you know, our traffic is going to them and their traffic's coming to us. So it is pretty useful.
Yeah, okay. I don't know if it is Identity Europa that's been part of that. Anyway, guys with the boat, if you're listening, reach out and we can settle that. We certainly, of course, support what you guys are doing. That's it's great. I mean, obviously, activism on the ground is very important, and it's very good. And they did raise some money for it, of course, as well. But, you know, again, we can talk about what you guys are doing and not them at this point, but just wanted to clarify that so people understand that it's two different groups. It can be quite confusing, obviously. But when was the site started again, guys? How many, is it a year ago? Is it more, less?
Less. I mean, the Twitter, we've had a Twitter account for about 5 months, I think, or 6 months. The website has only been going since, I believe, the beginning of April. So not long. And in that time, we've amassed quite a large reader base. So it's grown, I'd say, exponentially in a very short space of time.
And what do you guys feel in terms of kind of where you want to go with it? Obviously, just a year in the process, less than a year in the process, very young. A lot of things can come out of something like this. But at this point, you guys feel you're primarily focused on news, bringing the issues that are of importance to you to kind of to the mainstream a bit, right? Trying to get the information out to normies, basically, right?
Yeah, I think when they first started, obviously I started a couple of months after, but there's kind of a lack of honest news out there. So, I mean, in the UK, for example, we've got the BBC and Sky, and they kind of don't really tell you what's going on. So that's why we started writing our own articles. But I think in the future, our plan is to kind of grow the reach of all of the platforms that we've got. So we've obviously got the Twitter and the Facebook accounts. We do want to shoot original content as well, but we've just had our YouTube channel suspended. So we need to try and look into that. And I think we were also kind of talking about in real life activism. But I think, as I mentioned before, when there's all been volunteers and having full-time jobs, that's maybe something for the future. But it is in the pipeline.
Very, very fake news. That's what's dominating the mainstream right now, obviously. And it's good that we have people that rise up and want to, of course, do something on their own. They want to basically make sure that people get the real information out there. How did you guys, maybe you can tell us individually how you guys got involved. I mean, it's like, what was it that kind of perked your interest? What took you in this direction? There's so many things that has happened in the last couple of years with the migrant crisis that I think personally has woken up a tremendous amount of people. But let's begin with you, Laura. What kind of, I mean, were you always on this page, or was there something in specific that kind of woke you up to these topics?
I've always been interested in politics. I did politics at uni and then politics at college and then at university. But I kind of felt like I was just kind of ranting to my friends all the time about stuff, and a lot of them weren't really interested. So when I discovered Defend Europe, that's why I got involved with it. But for me, the main issue is definitely the Islamisation of the UK and of Europe, I guess, as well. But I mean, I'm in my late 20s, and even just in the last 20 years, the country has changed so much. I mean, when I get the bus to work on a morning, I'd say there's probably only a quarter of people that are white. And no one dares to talk about this stuff. It's, you know, any other race in any other country is allowed to, but we're not allowed to. So I think that was kind of the issue for me. And obviously with Islam as well, we've had three terror attacks this year in the space of 3 months, and no one seems to be talking about that, and no one's got a plan. Our Prime Minister, Theresa May, she has just said that she wants to monitor the internet, and that's pretty much all she said. So I think, yeah, those are the key issues for me, Islam and population replacement.
How about for you, William?
Well, I sort of half similar story. I mean, I didn't, I wasn't clever enough to study politics at university, sadly, but I'm a historian, and I've always had an interest in history, European history, and equally I've always loved writing. And I think that my interest in history led me to politics naturally because of you know, the state of European history. And I think seeing things repeat themselves and seeing the same patterns, it would be criminal to see these things and not to write about them and not to try and influence the information war in some way. So that's my, you know, motivation, that I feel that it's important to talk about these things, everything that Laura mentioned and more, because it's the same mistakes, and we've got to help people to understand that.
Yeah, I mean, I think you guys are fairly young, and as you said, Laura, I mean, things have transformed incredibly just in the last 20, 30 years. I mean, it was a vastly different country, the UK, than it was, you know, 30 years ago. And I don't think that the older generations are, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if they truly understand what they have done, or I guess the better term would be not done, because they haven't really objected to it. It's been such a slow process, and then eventually people just find themselves in a situation where they are in the minority, like in London right now, you know, where white people are, of course, fleeing. It's white flight on top of it, but it's also this issue that they just they're being slowly kind of replaced. What would you guys like to, let's assume that you had the ear of the older generations. What would you like to say to them as a general statement of how it is to grow up in Britain under the conditions that they created?
Oh, that's a difficult question. I think, do you know, a lot of the old people that I know, like my family and the people where I'm from, they've totally been against this as well, you know, throughout their lives and throughout their voting history. So the country's, it feels like it's pretty torn at the minute between, obviously it's not as extreme as this, but it kind of feels like we've got the Jeremy Corbyn sort of left-wing supporters, and then we've got like a more right-wing kind of patriotic group of people. I mean, it kind of was a Labour government that kind of opened up the doors and did all this in, I think 2004 was the year where it all kind of kicked off. But yeah, I'm not sure really. I think the people that I know would kind of agree with me on this, and they were always against it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so it's just that they didn't they didn't do anything though, right? That's the issue in a way. They just went along with the politicians, because on one level I thought they thought, hey, it's not going to change that much. It's just, we're just going to help people out. We're just going to bring in some refugees and immigrants, right?
I think I would probably say I would agree with Laura to the point that a lot of the older generations have always been against this transformation. But I would say that mostly they've been tricked. They've been gullible is their biggest crime, because after the war they were told, oh, you need these workers, you know, we need foreigners. And, you know, every step along the way there's been trick after trick. And I think their biggest crime is being a bit gullible.
I mean, I remember reading the articles about the Blair government, how they sought to intentionally bring in as many people as possible. I don't know if they saw them as a voter block or whatever it was. It was basically like a finger to the white working class, a middle finger towards a white working class, and they wanted to basically make sure that also the Tories wouldn't win, right? There's all these political kind of interest groups within that. I don't know how true that is. Maybe Blair is someone who basically is in the pocket of other interest groups and globalists, and he's just kind of fulfilling that that agenda basically. But it is true though, obviously, that Blair was behind it, and he was the one who opened the doors. So I think specifically after 2004, millions of people came into the UK at that point. But that was intentional, right, guys? That was not like, oh, it was just an accident of some side issue to the migration policies. This was an intentional policy, right?
Yeah, I'd say that was intentional. Labour were in power from 1997 to 2010. I was reading some statistics, actually, and migrants entered the UK at an average rate of one per minute during those years. And 75% of jobs created went to migrants, even though we had 1.5 million unemployed Brits in the country. So, yeah, but it didn't actually get any better under the Tories when they came into power in 2010, because net immigration figures, I think it's around 300,000 per year at the minute that we're running it. So even though we've got a new government, it's exactly the same.
Yeah, and I think to expand on that with Tony Blair, he was very friendly with the big business. You know, he privatized everything that Thatcher missed. And he was very keen to get this low-skilled, cheap labor force into the country. And I think that my best guess is that he is... He's on the side of the banks. He's on the side of the businesses, and I think that was his motivation, because he genuinely believes in this sort of, you know, cheap labor, free market nonsense.
Yeah, I mean, I know that Blair was received something called the Charlemagne Prize. I think it was in 2000 from the. It's a kind of a European Union prize. It's for, you know, doing the right thing, and he has, of course, always been very pro Europe. But that's not in the European sense that you guys are thinking of it, and how you're using the term. They're of course trying to create a superstructure. They're trying to create a completely different continent, and My own mind always goes back to that gentleman called Coudenhove Kalergi, the guy who actually advocated for a mixed European race in one of his books. And he, together with actually one of the Habsburgs, was one of the founders of the pan-European idea. And I know that Tony Blair was very, he was an admirer of those ideas. And I think he wanted to push it in that direction. So I think he's also in the pocket of the European politicians overall. What do you guys know about that? And what do you think about the greater kind of EU plan to supersede the different national interests that exists, and then to try to basically, to most people, it sounds, of course, that it's a pro-European position that these people take. But I think it's primarily an anti-European perspective. What do you guys think about that?
Yeah, I think, the first thing I'd say is that these people are not pro-European. They are, you're quite right, they're anti-European, and they are not trying to integrate the same Europe. They are trying to create a new Europe, which is devoid of culture, it's devoid of intelligence, it's devoid of racial identity, it's devoid of national identity. And that's not the Europe we're in favour of. And I think that whilst it's probably not a direct linear conspiracy, I do think that people like Blair and Merkel, they are all very on board, very intelligent, intellectually on board with the founding ideas, the pan-Europe movement, and I hope I can say this on your show, but the bastardised Europe that was envisaged by that man.
Mm-hmm. No, of course. No, that's absolutely true, and that's what he wants. It's in his own writing, and he, of course, Kalergi himself was half Japanese. I think his father married some Japanese royalty, I believe, or something like that, and he was well in with the European elite at that time, and I guess he just envisioned the rest of Europe to be as him or something like that. I really don't know. Obviously, there's more people than Kalergi involved in this, but you know, just to emphasize that these people give each other prizes. Merkel received the same prize in 2008. There's many other of these anti-European politicians that has received it. And I think that they are envisioning kind of a new European, like, holy empire of some kind. But what do you guys think about the Brexit issue, if we bring that into the equation now? Does that mean that things are going in an opposite direction in terms of what they want, or is business as usual just going to continue in Britain, guys?
It's kind of been dragged out for over a year now, Brexit. I don't even really think we know what kind of direction we're going in. There was so much state and media propaganda before the actual vote. I voted Leave, and then I didn't believe that we were going to win. I don't even think I checked the results straight away when I woke up, but a year's gone on, and it just kind of feels like anything that can get in the way kind of has gone in the way. And obviously there's lots of conversations going on between us and the EU, and they're kind of trying to charge us for things. And then, I mean, our Prime Minister, Theresa May, she backed Remain anyway, so I don't really feel like her heart's in it. She keeps appointing people as well now that also backed Remain. So I'm not really convinced that it is going to change much, to be honest. How do you feel, William?
Well, I think that Brexit was a genuine slip up for the European elites. I don't think it was part of the plan at all, but I think that never wants to miss an opportunity. The Bilderberg types, the global financiers of this time, are now seeing an opportunity. They can turn the UK into Europe's Hong Kong. They want us to be the playground of big capital. You're going to see our corporation tax go through the floor. You're going to see lots of state-owned assets stripped, and you're going to see, I think, a lot of damage done to the country. That's not to say that I'm not in favour of Brexit. I am, of course, in favour of Brexit, but I think that if the people in power can, they will use it as an opportunity to further their aims.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, let's talk about the issue of why you guys think that they are doing this and what drives these people. I mean, William, you're going kind of for the financial angle there, and I tend to agree with that for most of the time. I think that they're seeing these weakened nations as something ultimately that's just good for business, right? I mean, they can bring in low wage workers, they can drive down the wages. Countries such as Sweden, for example, who traditionally have had a very strong, labor union movement and stuff like that, that has been actually slowly broken down due to immigration, because many people in government they're forced to realize, okay, well, we can't keep up these wages for everyone. It will be a situation where basically immigrants are not going to go to work, and then everyone else, the native population, have to go to work and pay for all of this. So one of the solutions has been to remove those strong labor unions and basically get people into the workforce. But the employers can drive down the wages, which is ultimately beneficial to them. And then in the long term, you have this issue too of what generally tends to happen in multicultural societies is that people actually tend to, for example, stay home more indoors. They tend to consume more. And some of the reasons for this, people think, is, of course, because people are feeling largely unhappy, right? That they are, they're missing a genuine connection with other people. If your neighborhood begins to transform, the cohesion goes out of that neighborhood, and you tend to be basically a better consumer. It's really that simple. You have an emptiness inside, and you fill that with stuff, right? And it's good, therefore, for the kind of the capitalist system. I don't know how much they've looked at this and analyzing this, but somewhere along the line they've realized that the numbers is going in this direction. What do you guys think about that in terms of the financial aspect? That is it primarily capitalism and the markets and the bankers that are driving this because it's good for business? Or is it really, truly that they want to replace us as a population inside of our countries?
I would argue that it's a bit of both. I think that after the Second World War, people stopped talking about societal virtue in terms of, culture and philosophy, and started talking about GDP. And now GDP is the only good way to measure a nation's success. I think these people are fanatical. All they see is numbers, and low-skilled workers make the numbers go up, and that's all they see. But I think there is a sinister side, especially on the left, whereby a lot of the people on the left seem to see a large influx of non-European people as the antidote to what they see as racism. They see our societies as inherently racist, and they believe that if we are mixed race, if we are like some of the South American countries, then it will end racism and it will end colonialism and all the other nonsense. And I think that is the sinister aspect of it, that they see only bad in the European races.
Yeah, I completely agree. You only need to look on social media to hear people talking about white genocide and saying that it's an incredible thing and you deserved it and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, it definitely is happening in England at the moment. I think it's the year 2066. If trends continue as they are doing, then white Britons will be a minority in our country by the year 2066.
Yeah, and that does constitute as genocide according to the UN definition. It says in the convention itself that obviously the most obvious one that people think of is killing members of the group, right? But that's not, well, although that's happening, that's not directly what we're kind of discussing here. So this is Article 2, and then there's 4 points to that. B says causing serious bodily or mental harm to the members of the group, and I would argue that what we're subjected to is mental harm. With us basically being told that we are racists and we are evil and we're the slave drivers, we are the ones who are behind colonialism, therefore, ergo, we are evil. That's mental harm. C says deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated, and that's the important part, calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. We should be able to argue that what these financiers is doing is a calculated effort to bring about the physical destruction of parts of our group, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And the media are completely behind it. I mean, there was a, did you see the Guardian article that went around a few days ago where it was encouraging white people to have less children?
That's right. But yep.
I pulled one up from, I'm not sure what it was, but before, where they were saying that we have a population decline at the minute, so we need immigration. So it kind of feels like they're saying we need to have less children, but then we need more migrants in to balance the population out.
And someone did you see that, Laura? Someone also did headlines. They pulled out the web version, I think it was The Guardian, and showed that every time that they talked about children and births and stuff like that in other articles, they actually did show mixed race children or non-white children in the articles. But then this article, when they talked about, you know, we have to have fewer kids, then is the first time ever almost they all have all white children in the images that they used for the article. It's amazing.
Every time. It can't be a coincidence. It's every time, isn't it?
Yeah, I'd agree. I think the media are definitely complicit in this kind of thing. They're almost like the cheerleaders, aren't they? They stand at the side and they laugh at us and they cheer on impending doom. But I think, going back to the definitions of genocide, I think as well, the financiers of society have created conditions. I mean, if you go to any native family in England and you say, if they've got one child, and you say, why don't you have more children? And they will say, 9 out of 10 will say to you, we want to, we'd love to have more children, but we can't afford it. We both work full time and we can't afford it. And those financial conditions that have been put in place, that means that a man and a woman in a reasonable job cannot afford childcare, and they can't afford the basic necessities to have children. Those are conditions that could have been avoided. After the war, we could have said, right, we're going to incentivize our people to have children. No, there were options, but instead they chose to disincentivize us and they chose to take the more sinister route. And yeah. I think that that's something that really needs to be understood by people, is how these conditions have been, that it could have been avoided, but they chose not to.
Yeah, it's not an accident. That's what people need to understand. This is quite intentional. What's at the root of that, guys? I mean, you mentioned it, William. You're talking about, of course, that even just on a fundamental liberalist, leftist, progressive point of view, they probably saw that, well, after the Second World War, this, we can't have this happen again. This is what these horrible white people do. Doesn't matter that they fought, of course, Nazism and all these things. At this point, every nation that was involved in some way is almost seen as guilty. And I think that they're thinking, if we can prevent these groups from, you know, building up their nation again and becoming a proud nation once again, then we will probably be able to prevent a future war. I mean, for some of them anyway, for some of the elite, I really think that that is how simplistic they view the situation, that if we can break down their homogeneity, it's not going to happen again. However, we're of course seeing a different kind of conflict now. In their efforts to try to, maybe if we grant them this moral high ground, I think that's debatable, but let's grant them that for the sake of the argument. They're doing this because they want to save people or prevent war or something like that. What's happening in these multicultural societies now is a completely different type of, I don't know, what do we call it, asymmetrical warfare. It's kind of internal civil war. It's on very small scale most of the time, of course, but gangs have been brought into the picture. We're suffering from that significantly in many parts of Sweden right now, where these criminal gangs have started setting up cartels. They're basically extorting businesses. I read an article the other day of garbage collectors that actually had forced this woman who owned a bakery to pay them like thousands of crowns every month when they came by, or they would destroy her property and stuff like that. I mean, this is unheard of in our society before, and this is almost exclusively driven by the immigrant class. So guys, I mean, this didn't lead to a conflict-free world. It's quite the opposite. It's more conflict now than ever, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Not even just crime, but obviously terrorism as well. I think the terrorist attacks that we had over the last few months, at least one of them was from immigration. I think the other two were born here, but obviously their parents might have been immigrants as well. I'll have to check that. But yeah, we definitely do have a crime problem with non-whites in the country. So, for example, Muslims, who make up 5% of the population, take up 14% of prison spaces. Black people are 3% of the population, but 13% of prison spaces. Knife crime, shooting, sexual violence, it's all on the up in London as well. And it's not, unfortunately, the native population that are behind that.
No, it's definitely not. It's very strange because, you know, William, going back to your point again with the financial anger and stuff like that, I think also that they're very short term in their thinking. We might be in a situation right now where it's temporarily has benefited the financial class, but what I'm seeing at the end of the road of the path that they've set us on is complete financial ruin. I mean, this costs tremendous amounts of money. Many of the, especially of course, refugees and the more recent migrants that are coming into European countries, they are not working. They are not entering into the workforce. They have to be helped by the government. They're getting allowances. They're getting apartments paid for. They end up taking resources, finances, all of that stuff from the native population, if you will. I see financial ruin at the end of this, and with the increasing instability with terrorism and things like this, this is not going to bode well for the financial class either, is it?
No, I mean, essentially, I guess if I labour the financial standpoint, that it's essentially created a very large credit bubble, whereby for short term, you know, labour surplus, therefore economic growth, you've also got a large class of people who are having to be supported. And they're not being supported from budget surplus. They are being, I think Germany is the only country in Europe that still manages to run a budget surplus. Every other country in Europe is essentially borrowing money to fund this mass social experiment. And you're absolutely right that I think even though in the short term the figures might look good on paper for the financial class, in the long term, this bubble is going to burst. And all the while, you've still got this violence, you've still got this crime, this disharmony within societies. And that's only going to get worse when the money dries up. So you're absolutely right. Short-term thinking, and they're really storing up problems for the future. And the problems, they're going to affect the native population the most because we've got nowhere to go.
No, this is all we got. We can't flee. You know, we can't flee to anywhere else. We would probably not even be let in anywhere else, right?
Exactly. So, you know, you're right. It's short term, and this bubble is going to burst, and it's going to burst, you know, very loudly.
And I can't help to think as well that on some weird level, I kind of just want that scenario to come about, and almost I feel the sooner the better, because I'd rather take a short period of a very difficult scenario or difficult circumstances than a long term slow death, if you will, of our people, where we slowly are replaced and maybe also mixed out eventually, so that eventually there will be no, you know, native people left in Europe. That's a very real scenario and very real, you know, possibility. And if the financiers may you know, can maintain financial stability and can maintain the status quo, then I think that's the more plausible scenario. That's why I'm almost personally right. I mean, I don't want to see that. I don't want to see hardship. I don't want to see strife to a certain extent. But just to get out of the situation, I'm almost hoping for that as a way for us to kind of shake them off of our backs, if you guys see what I'm saying.
I'm not really sure what to add to it, but yeah, I agree with you. I'd definitely take that option and kind of just get it over with and then sort it out ourselves, I guess, rather than, like you said, the kind of slow, agonizing death that seems to be going on at the minute.
Yeah, William, what do you think? What do you favor here as a scenario?
Well, it's difficult, isn't it? I mean, like you said, nobody wants to see hardship, but I think it's going to happen one way or another. And people often say that you know, extreme ideas only gain traction when in economic ruin. But I think the more correct term would be that radical ideas become more attractive because people who have been enjoying their two-week holiday and their steady job, as soon as that's gone, they realize exactly who has been directing their society. And when the money dries up, they will see what we have been saying. And I genuinely believe that. And I think that I'm inclined to agree with you that, you know, a crash, a bit of hardship, it would be akin to a good shake and a waking up for a lot of people. And I think that would be, in the long term, that would be very beneficial to our continent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I remember that video, it's a few years ago now. I don't know if you guys remember it, but it was, I think her name was it Emma Watson, maybe? She was sitting on that train in England and like basically all of a sudden, it probably just hit her. She was like, she was basically freaking out. She realized that she was like, she's not in her own country anymore. She was surrounded by foreigners, by foreign people. And she had a young child in her lap. And she was just, you know, basically started almost screaming at these people and like, you know, get out. What are you doing here? Like, this is my country. This is my people's country. I feel like a foreigner in my own, you know, land and stuff like that. And she was, I believe she was... they called the cops on her. They located her. I think she was arrested. I did follow up on the story, but I forget the details of it and what happened to her. But it was this horrible situation where she probably all of a sudden this dawned on her and she just snapped basically. She couldn't take it anymore. And I think that this is something which is very difficult for the foreigners who are in our countries to understand. That it's like this is ours. This is the only countries that we have. They have fled from a country, sure, but at the end of the day, they could always go back there, and that country will be, I mean, almost most likely full of their own people. It will be full of their own culture, their own customs, and all that stuff. We are being encroached into that space, and it doesn't exist for us anymore, and that's a how do I put it? Almost a claustrophobic experience or realization. I think that she had that at that moment and she just snapped. She couldn't take it anymore. But that's how I feel sometimes. Do you guys remember the video? I don't know if you were out of the loop at that time. It's a few years ago now.
No, it's not familiar to me. I will Google it though.
Yeah, it's
William.
I did, and I can't remember the woman's name, whether it was Emma Watson or something similar, but I vaguely remember hearing about it because there was a lot of, you know, a lot of people calling for blood, a lot of the typical types on the internet, you know, arrest her, lock her up, this sort of thing. So I remember it from that perspective, yeah.
Emma West, sorry, not Watson, Emma West.
West, is that the one?
Yeah, and this is in 2011. 34-year-old British woman has multiple racist outbursts on a Croydon to Wimbledon tram link. take a look at that, guys. Let's Google that later. It's interesting because I mean we are not allowed to have those kinds of outbursts or experiences. We're not allowed to feel those things, right? We're in a situation where we basically have to suppress those emotions, and if we feel in any way at all territorial or feel, you know, this is ours, we have broken that moral moral code, if you will. But this is what's happening in our countries. I mean, you said that earlier, Laura. I mean, you were talking about the incredible, you know, replacement that's happening in your country. I mean, in the area that you're in, rather. But yet people seem to suppress it, right? They just seem, it's fine, look the other way, or I don't know what they're thinking. Maybe they're thinking this is going to end one day, or we're just going to get used to it. I mean, do you guys think that the following generations to us, if they remain white, will be okay with this situation? Will they be fine with it? Or are they going to be fine in a world like that?
I think two things. I do speak about this to people quite a lot, and I think partly some people just don't care. I mean, sometimes I've mentioned it to people and they've said, well, I'll just move, and it's like, well, move where? Or they've just said, you know, I don't care what colour people are or what culture it is. But then I think there's also another group of people who are actually just scared to talk about it. Because, you know, in certain situations, when you do mention this, you get called a fascist and Islamophobic and a Nazi and all kind of things. I mean, it's the youth, really, that's kind of replacing us. Our fertility rate in the UK is 1.78, which is under the recommended rate of 2.1 for our population to stay the same. But we have a growing Pakistani community whose fertility rate is 3.82. Afghanistan is 4.25 and Somalia is 4.19. So they are actually just having a lot more kids than we're having. We've actually got 80 schools in the UK that don't have a single white child in them. And actually, one in nine schools in England and Wales do not teach English as their first language. But if you say, oh, my child's in a class with a load of kids that don't speak English, you get told that you're racist and you're not allowed to mention that. But obviously, that's not fair on your child. They're going to be held back in the classroom. So I think a lot of people kind of are on our side, and it is something that they care about, but they're just maybe a little bit too scared to talk about it.
Yeah. Ugh, it's so bizarre. I'm reading the article now from 2013 about Emma West. She admitted to racially aggravated disorderly behavior, likely to cause harassment or distress, right? She was bound over to keep the peace and handed a 24-month community order. A judge said West was clearly suffering from mental health problems at the time of the outburst. Was like, yeah, because this environment she's in is causing mental anguish. That's why, I don't know, it's just so bizarre. I don't know if we're going to see more of those kinds of things. And I'm frankly, I don't know what you guys think, but I'm frankly surprised that we don't see more of them. Maybe it does happen, but maybe it's not filmed or something. I don't know. It's very. I put it this way: there's no one on the planet that is so tolerant as European people. That's how I see this. We're too tolerant. We're so tolerant. We're willing to give up our own territory, walk away from it, just to not be called a racist. That's what it boils down to, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Sorry. Yeah, I think there's a lot of British society. I think there's a little bit of an arrogance and a bit of complacency in our people. I don't know about Europe, but in England, where you say to somebody, oh, you know, in 50 years, we're going to be a minority, and they say, oh, no, don't be silly. But if you were to say to them on a one-to-one basis, so how would you feel if you, when you're old and you're vulnerable, you are the only person that speaks English on your street, how would you feel? And then all of a sudden that reality comes home to them. And I think that a lot of people, if they really thought about it in those terms, would see where we're coming from. They would understand a bit better, I think.
Yeah, definitely. So guys, let's just take a short break here in a couple of minutes, and then we'll pick up, talk more about this. This is an interesting discussion here in terms of just the realization of becoming a minority, what happens in people's minds when this sets in. I do believe many are just incapable to kind of comprehend and understand what that really means. And the other part of this equation is maybe it would be fine for most people if it's not something that's brought up to them constantly, right? In other words, if they wouldn't be, let's say, reminded that they are white or European or English, whatever term you prefer, maybe that would be an okay situation to be in for many of them. But if they were all of a sudden were to be, let's say, abused, if they were to be maybe even attacked or whatever because of the fact that other people around them, non-white people, will see them as kind of an enemy or the representation of racism or you know, colonialist past or something, then that would be an incredibly different scenario. Who knows in what direction this is going to go, right? Is this going to turn into the kind of violence and oppression that we've seen against white people in South Africa, for example? Is that what's going to come to most European countries. If that's the case, I don't think many people would want to be in that scenario. But by the time it's at their own doorstep, it's kind of too late. They would notice it too late. So that's some of the other questions I want to kind of get into in the second segment as we continue to talk about this. I want to get into Rotherham as well, some of the issues that has arisen due to terrorism, what some of the responses and reactions are to that, and basically where Islam is in the UK right now with that as the equation, as it were. But guys, before we take a quick break here, tell people about the website. Tell us if you guys have something, I don't know, specific going on, if there's any way that you're reaching out either people to join your group or if they can help you guys out in any way. Give us the details, if you will.
I mentioned some of the stuff that we talk about on the website at the beginning, things like the migrant crisis, Islam, the EU, the establishment. I think for us, one of the key things really is just to spread that information around, to share the articles with people and to engage in discussions with people. We've all got our individual Twitter accounts that we engage with, the Defend Europa followers on. But it would be great if people could follow us and maybe share some of the information and tell us what they think as well. I actually do learn quite a lot from our followers. We've got a really cool group of followers on Twitter, and I'll write something and then they'll provide extra information. So it is just the dialogue really that we're getting going with people at this stage and just trying to inform people and educate people and learn ourselves in the meantime as well.
Yeah, and I think if I can just expand on that, I think Laura's absolutely right that we do want to engage, but I guess this is an information war, and at this point what we really want to do is to be able to win people over with our work. We want to get the necessary information out there, and of course we are always looking for contributors. I'm sure some of your listeners will be capable writers. And do you mind if I just read out the email address and website, things like that?
No, please go ahead.
Yeah, so if you want to, if you're a reasonable writer and you want to contribute to our projects in any way, then the email address is info@defendeuropa.org. And that's EV, not EU, in Europa. Similarly, the website, defendeuropa.org, it's a great site. We've just relaunched it. We've got some really great stuff on there, so please check it out.
We'll have links up, guys, so definitely check it out. A lot of good news, a lot of good articles on there. The Twitter account, of course, is the same, Defend Europa, and we'll have that linked up as well if you guys want to follow. But yeah, we'll just take a short break here, guys, and then we'll be back with a little bit in just a few minutes. Pick up much more to discuss with William and Laura. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.